I'm Joanna Shanks.
I'm Emma Taylor.
And this is Murder, She Spoke.
Oh, Joanna, how have you been?
I'm good, yeah, I've been really good. I have been on a bit of a true crime hiatus past week, to be honest.
I'm disappointed in you.
Maybe I just needed a break, I don't know, maybe it was like overload, but yeah, I haven't been watching much in the way of documentaries, and I actually haven't been listening too much in the way of podcasts either. I've really been listening to music, and I've kind of been a bit busy just kind of outside, I guess, because things are easing up a little bit now. I'm probably just making the most of it. I've been out running and things like that. Tonight, I went to pick up my wedding dress.
Oh, that's so exciting.
So, yeah, picked it up tonight, which was pretty cool. So, yeah, I have that now. And also, didn't expect this to happen so soon. I actually didn't expect to be booked in until next year, but I was contacted by the tattoo studio for the place where I'm getting a tattoo, and I'm booked in for my first session in 3 weeks.
Oh my goodness.
I know, so I was a bit like, okay, this is a lot sooner than I expected.
Wow. So what are you going for? Tell everyone.
So basically I haven't decided if it's going to be a half or three quarter sleeve.
Mm-hmm. From the top down or from the bottom up?
Yeah, from the top down.
Yeah.
On my arm. So yeah, I think it's going to be about four full day sessions, mm-hmm. but it's with an amazing artist in Essex. So called Leanne Moule. So yeah, I am going there 3 weeks on Saturday, so I am slightly nervous.
And so, what are you getting done exactly?
So it's basically, so there's a bunch of images that I've sent over to her, and what she'll do is she'll paint like a sort of watercolor mock-up of what it's going to be, and it's just loads of sort of bright flowers, and there's some bees and it's like fox.
Oh.
And there's like my little cat that passed away, and yeah, it's I love the images so much. I've also got Absalom, you know, from Alice in Wonderland in there, and it's just, the images are just so colorful and bright, and honestly her art is just amazing. Honestly, it's just, it's like having a painting on your body.
That's amazing.
They are so beautiful. I cannot emphasize how beautiful they are. And I'd been swithering about getting one for a while, and you know, I thought if I was gonna do it, it would have to be with a really good artist, something that, you know, I would be proud to be wearing, you know, on my body for the rest of my life, basically. Yeah, this is absolutely it. So yeah, her stuff is just incredible. She's done some absolutely beautiful mastectomy cover-ups and stuff as well.
I love that.
Yeah, I mean, she's just really, really talented. So I'm really, really excited to see what she comes up with for me.
Oh,
and yeah, to get my first session. So I don't know when my next session will be after that, so I might have to wait until next year for my next session. But yeah, basically I'm expecting to get about a quarter of it done in 3 weeks time. So yeah, that's pretty much it for me. I haven't really been doing too much else. What about you?
Yeah, same. I'm not being super busy. I do not have any exciting body modifications going on. For one thing, I'm terrified of needles, so there's that. Yeah, I know. Plus, I don't know. It's just one of those things that I love them on other people, but I changed my mind so much about everything.
Yeah.
I don't know if I would still love it, which is kind of a creepy thought to have. Although everyone that I know, even when they've changed their minds on tattoos, they still love them because they represent a specific moment in their life. So I do know that. But yeah, and I think also when I was younger, I was really worried about not being able to get you know, like a professional job, that kind of thing. But I don't really worry about that anymore. It doesn't really bother me. So yeah, maybe one day I'll just get it done. But I don't know. We'll see. I have been listening to a couple of podcasts.
Mm-hmm.
So I've got a bit of true crime info for our listeners who I know seems like people do like our recommendations, you know, when it comes to documentaries, podcasts, even films, things like that. Mm-hmm. So there is a lovely lady that you know as well called Fern, who we are friends with on Twitter, yes, who runs a podcast, yes, a British podcast called Evidence of a Crime. And not only is she super lovely, she, you know, researches everything really well and presents it really well. And yeah, so I've been listening to a bit of her podcast. And the one that the episode that I really liked, that I really remembered, is actually the first one that's available, is around the disappearance of Leah Croucher, who was a young girl down south in England. And it's actually coming up for her 21st birthday. And her family are doing a bit of a renewed appeal at the minute. So maybe if people want to go and have a listen to that, I think it'll be in the news a bit more. So yeah, Evidence of a Crime. Definitely recommend that podcast if anyone wants to check it out.
Do you want to tell me about your case this week?
So the case, I was actually quite surprised that I hadn't heard about this case before. It's actually quite a gruesome incident. And it was fairly well publicised, although not so much down kind of Edinburgh way. It happened in and around Montrose.
Okay.
And it's the case of Kimberly McKenzie. Have you heard of this case at all?
It doesn't ring a bell at all.
Okay. Yeah, no, absolutely the same to me. And I was really quite amazed when I started reading into it because, like I said, it's quite shocking and it's quite gruesome. So we'll proceed and just to put that out there for people who maybe a little bit sensitive, just
a little content warning.
Yeah, a little content warning. Obviously, this did happen to a real person, and we are here to tell the facts and try and do it as respectfully as possible. But sometimes the things that we tell you aren't nice, unfortunately. Kimberly McKenzie was 37 years old in 2015. She lived in Montrose in Scotland. Montrose is a coastal town 38 miles north of Dundee and 42 miles south of Aberdeen. So it's, how far would we say north of Edinburgh? So Edinburgh's kind of central Scotland, they would call it. So it's on the coast on the North Sea. Yeah, on the northeast. And it would take us a good 2.5 hours, it would take for me, where I am, just outside of Edinburgh. Historically, it was a port in medieval times. It traded in skins and salmon. And interestingly, it was also ransacked and razed to the ground by Danish invaders, which I had no idea until I had a look on Wikipedia. So there you go. In modern times, it still functions as a port, but obviously not to any great extent. But the main employer is a pharmaceutical company, GlaxoSmithKline. They make a lot of medicine. Data that was published by the Scottish Neighbourhood Statistics, and this is back in 2008, but there aren't any more recent ones. It records the population as around about 15,000. Of that total, around 12% are unemployed, and about 14% of the households are classed as income deprived. And to put that into perspective, current statistics for Edinburgh show unemployment sitting around 2.4%. So it's nearly 10% higher. So Kimberly McKenzie, she was a mother of three. As a child, she moved around Scotland with her farm worker father, who was called Terence, and her mother, who was called Helen. They settled in Aberdeenshire. She went to school in Huntley in Aberdeenshire.
Mm-hmm.
She left at the age of 16 and the family moved to Lookers, which is in Fife near St Andrews. She married later on in 1998, and she had her first son in July the following year. She got divorced in the early 2000s and moved to Newborough in Fife, where she gave birth to a daughter in 2003. And then 2 years later, she moved to Montrose and had a son, so around 2005. So she'd been in Montrose roughly 10 years when this happened. Her father lived fairly close by. He raised the alarm when she didn't meet him. He'd arranged to meet her. He dropped her off on the high street in Montrose to go to a pharmacy, and she was meant to go and pick up her bank card from him later on. That never happened, and he ended up reporting her missing. Her father he was aware that Kim actually had a drug habit, and she had been in an on and off again relationship with a local drug dealer called Stephen Jackson. So Mr. McKenzie had said, I'd met him, but I'd never spoken to him face to face. I met him at his house a couple of months before she passed away. I told her for the sake of the children, she had to give the drugs up, but she never listened. So this guy, Stephen Jackson, he'd been going out with Kim for several months, and then they split up in the summer of 2015. The relationship reportedly ended with Kim's belongings being thrown out into the street in front of Jackson's flat, but apparently it was amicable and they stayed in touch as friends. And I would imagine because she was still taking drugs, that may have played into them maintaining a relationship as well. The timeline of events seems to have been as follows. A few days before she was last seen by her father, on the 24th of October in 2015, she got a text message from Stephen's phone telling her she was no longer welcome in his home. And she was quite confused by this message because she didn't think anything had changed. She didn't know why he was telling her this. Just a little bit more background on Stephen Jackson. He was 39 years old at the time, and he dealt everything from heroin to legal highs to the locals. He was on several bail orders at the time, and he was well known to local law enforcement. There are reports from drug users who visited him that he had knives, a machete and other tools lying around the flat, some for cutting drugs and some for protection. He reportedly even had a man who would come around to inject him with heroin every morning. And in exchange, he would give the man some of his own heroin to use for free.
Did you say he had a man that would come round and inject him with heroin?
Yep. So Stephen Jackson had a person who would come to his house and inject him with heroin. I don't know why he wasn't injecting himself, but I thought that was odd as well.
Yeah, strange.
And yeah, apparently he would accept sexual favours if people couldn't pay. So that gives us a kind of background as to his character. So Stephen and Kimberly had been an item, however they had split, and Stephen was with a new partner, 27-year-old Michelle Higgins. So yeah, she received this message from him on the 24th of October, and that was baffling to her. She didn't really understand what the deal was. However, on the 25th, she was spotted by a friend in the local co-op with him. And he apparently told her that he didn't send her the message. It was his new girlfriend. He said that his new girlfriend, Michelle Higgins, was a psycho, a bunny boiler, and she'd sent this message. Kim spent the evening with her best friend, Penny Farrell, at her house. And she left with Penny's 19-year-old son, Danny, and went back to his flat, slept with him, and they spent the night together.
Yeah. The 19-year-old boy.
Yeah. Okay. It has been stated by several sources that Kim was quite a vulnerable person and obviously had a drug problem. I think we maybe need to take some of that into account when we're looking at choices that she made.
I'm just looking at it in the same view as I would look at it if it was an older man with a younger female.
Of course. The 24th, she gets the text. The 25th, she's in the co-op. She goes to Penny's house. She leaves with Penny's son and they sleep together. The next day, that's the day her father drives her to the pharmacy. Around the same time, Danny, so Penny's son, goes back to his mum's home with his brother and his friend, and they tell her that he slept with his mum's best friend. She's absolutely furious. Her partner is called Philip Kahlo. He later testified and said that she went absolutely ballistic, couldn't believe that her best friend had slept with her son, which I would say is a pretty fair reaction to have.
For sure.
Yeah. Later on that day, Kim tries to go back to her best friend's home and they won't let her in because she's angry at her. The partner, Philip, went to Stephen Jackson's flat to buy legal highs to calm her down because she was so upset about what had happened. when they were there, they met Michelle Higgins, who was Stephen's new partner, and they told her that Kimberly had slept with Penny's son.
Okay. So this is a
it's all kind of small town gossip drama.
Yeah.
Essentially, yeah.
It's just like a sort of storm waiting to happen, isn't it?
Exactly. Yeah. It's a bunch of people on substances who are getting themselves very het up about things. Michelle Higgins produced a small dagger and asked them if they wanted something done about Miss Mackenzie. Later on, the son meets Kim again by chance in Lloyd's pharmacy, and she says, "Your mum's my best friend," essentially.
I made a mistake.
Later on, Kimberly goes to Stephen Jackson's and she is never seen alive again. The following day, Terence Mackenzie, so that's Kim's dad, went to Montrose police station, reported her missing. He's concerned that she never met him to collect her bank card, which he was keeping for her. The police visit Jackson's flat and tell him that Kim's missing, and they also question her best friend's partner, Philip, as well.
Is that Penny's partner?
Penny's partner, yep. The next day again, they go back to Jackson's flat. Stephen Jackson, that's the drug dealer. Sorry, there's quite a few people here, so I'm just trying to...
That's okay. Stephen Jackson is Kim's ex-boyfriend.
And Michelle's current partner.
Michelle's current partner.
Yeah. So they go to his flat, they search several rooms, and they find Michelle Higgins in the bedroom. In court, Michelle Higgins gives evidence that at this point, when they're searching the flat, the remains of Kim are bagged up in the kitchen, hidden behind the tumble dryer.
Oh my God.
On October 30th, a suitcase and a child's rucksack with Kim's head and other body parts are dumped at 73 William Phillips Drive, and they are spotted on CCTV dragging the suitcase through the town centre and carrying the rucksack.
Did you see her remains were found at an address?
Some of her remains, it's unclear. I think it's an associate who's not named.
Right, okay.
The police returned to Jackson's flat on an unrelated matter for an outstanding warrant, and they arrest him, and he spends the weekend in custody. Michelle Higgins, the following day, posts on Facebook that she's in a relationship with Jackson. The next again day, the 1st of November, Michelle Higgins sends a message to her father saying that she had escaped from a psychopath and she'd started seeing a guy she'd been chasing for 7 months. And this is about a different guy, not Jackson. This is a different person again. On November the 2nd, Jackson is bailed from Forfar Sheriff Court and is basically released back into the public. He goes to meet his ex-wife. Jackson's ex-wife is called Barbara White. He agrees to meet her on November the 3rd at the Fair of Blair pub in Blair Gowrie. They're joined by her teenage daughter. Jackson tells them that her friend Kimberly Mackenzie, so she must have known her as well, died of a drug overdose 2 weeks ago. Then Jackson and Miss White, his ex-wife, go to a guest house in Balmoral Road for reasons we can only speculate on. They're alone in the room and Jackson tells her how he and Michelle killed Kim at their flat and chopped up her body. Later on, Barbara White said that he appeared amused and laughed about the police visiting the flat while the body was in the bath. He apparently also made some unpleasant jokes and comments about Kim's physical size and shape.
Jesus.
Barbara White stated that in the guest house, he had a machete with him, also for reasons unknown. The following morning, November the 4th, they leave the guest house. she was pretty shaken, apparently, unsurprisingly. And she kicked him and ran to her mother's house. And then she later told police that he tried to get her to come back. Another friend, sorry, there's more people, I'm afraid. This is another witness, went to Jackson's flat.
It's like a Penny Vincenzi novel.
It is. Everyone knows everyone. So this has been spreading around pretty quickly. So a Miss Emsley goes to Jackson's flat to ask about her missing friend and says that there's no lights on, which is not normal. And apparently there is a strong rotten smell coming from inside. There are other people round about who see him looking a bit shifty and finding suspicious bags in their recycling bins, all this kind of stuff. So the guy that Michelle has started seeing, David Melville, this is the same day as all this is going on, is telling everyone that he started going out with Michelle. On this same day, we're still on November the 4th, the police returned to Jackson's flat, and Jackson says that he cut up her body, cut up her body and fed her to pigs. They then take him to the police station for further questioning, and then he says that Michelle Higgins attacked Kim with a hammer because she tried to offer Jackson sex in exchange for drugs, and she was a psychotic, jealous partner, so she killed her. That's the story.
Okay.
It's really quite mind-boggling. I mean, it's just so warped, the whole thing. It you can make this up. On November the 5th, unfortunately, that's the day that the police start finding body parts in bins throughout Montrose town centre, and they charge Jackson with murder. Meanwhile, Michelle Higgins and her new beau, David Melville, have taken an early morning trip to Aberdeen to not only celebrate their new relationship, but to buy heroin. November the 6th, Higgins is detained by police in Aberdeen, and she is later arrested and charged. So both Higgins and Jackson turn on each other and claim that the other one murdered Kim.
That's not predictable at all.
No, it's not. Unfortunately, you know, there's definitely a lot of truth in each of their statements, so they can piece together. They've not been bright enough to change it enough, you know, so that it doesn't match the evidence. Mm-hmm. So we do have a fairly complete picture of what actually happened.
Let me guess, they're both as culpable as each other?
Well, you may be a little frustrated at the sentencing, is all I'm going to say.
Okay. I'll let you finish.
From their testimonies and the evidence that was found, it's believed that Kim was struck on the right side of her head 10 or 11 times with a claw-like hammer. She was also stabbed, likely with a ski and do, and she was reportedly hit with a large paint scraper. That was the last blow. I'm talking a lot, so I'll let you tell everyone what ski and do is.
A ski and do is basically, it's a small kind of dagger, usually has an ornate handle, and it is traditionally worn inside the sock of a man in traditional Scottish dress, which is, as most people would know, a kilt with sort of knee-high wool socks. And the ski and do would just literally sit just tucked into the top of the sock so that you can see the
handle.
Yeah, you can see the hilt of the ski and do just above the sock. So it's got an ornate handle, sometimes has an ornate stone in it as well.
Many of them, for dress reasons, are blunted as well.
Yeah, they never used to be, but now I think sometimes when you hire kilt wear, I think they're usually actually plastic now.
Yeah, well. A lot of them are.
Whereas they used to be proper metal daggers, and obviously that is a weapon. But the reason it's called a skindu is because it's a Scottish Gaelic word.
So that is that's one of the purported weapons that was used in this attack. Essentially, it looks like she went to the home and she was in it minutes, and one or other of them battered her around the head and then proceeded to further stab her and hurt her when she was already incapacitated on the floor.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, the accounts vary slightly, but that does match all the injuries. During the trial, there was a neuropathologist called Dr. William Stewart. He said that when he examined her brain, it suggested that she died an hour or so after the injuries were inflicted.
Oh, no.
And that if there had been medical intervention, the head injuries had been survivable.
That's just horrible. Not only could she have survived it, but also the fact that she would have suffered for an hour before she eventually passed away as well is horrible.
Yeah. So the following day, Michelle Higgins actually went out and purchased a saw, which was one of the implements used to dismember Kimberly's body. They dismembered her body in the flat into 12 parts.
The bathtub, I'm assuming?
In the bathtub, yeah, of the flat. They used bin bags, rucksack, and a suitcase to, you know, transport remains around Montrose. And yeah, so the body parts found in bins around the town included her arms, knees, and feet. And the other parts of the body, including her decapitated head, were placed in a rucksack, a child's rucksack, that belonged to one of Michelle's children, and a suitcase, and they were hidden in a shower cubicle at a house that we mentioned previously. And fairly readily available online, the Crown Court shared the CCTV footage if anyone wants to watch it for whatever reason. And you can see them, quite the thing, rolling the suitcase through the town, bold as brass. Apparently on that day as well, they were wandering about holding hands, which just boggles your mind, really. Apparently on the day, on the same day when she went to buy the saw, he messaged her saying something along the lines of that he was having problems cutting her up. And she went back, mink, lol.
Mink.
So, yeah, it's kind of a northern phrase that means, oh, you're gross. You'd say, oh, you're a mink, like you're a bit disgusting, that kind of thing. But it can almost be an affectionate term as well.
Right.
So it'd be like, oh, you're a mink, lol. I mean, that just, they're talking about dismembering someone and cutting up their body in their bath. And they had that means they had her body lying around for some, you know, not
yeah, I was gonna
a small
say
number
that,
of hours.
I was going to say that there's clearly no remorse there because they've had time to reflect on what's happened and what they've done.
Yeah.
And it doesn't sound like they're actually struggling with this decision or what they've decided to do. Or certainly she's not. He's indicated that he has some difficulty. That might just be physical difficulty, though. That might not necessarily be a mental or emotional difficulty.
It sounded more like he needed a hand, to be honest.
Right.
So, yeah, that's essentially what happened. Like I said, they both tried to blame the other one. He showed no remorse. He had been obviously trying to tell the police that he'd fed her body to the pigs. He'd bragged about it to his ex-wife. He'd been joking about the size of her, the shape of her, things like that, which just completely sickens me. There's no respect in any way, shape or form. And like I said, it sounded like she was quite a troubled person. She'd moved around, you know, unfortunately she'd had a problem with drugs. And she'd obviously fallen in with this bad crowd. And I think the premise was that because she had slept with her best friend's son, that somehow this was her punishment. Or do you know, it seemed like that's what they were trying to kind of put across. And apparently her best friend Penny has felt guilt, a lot of guilt surrounding this. Because obviously she feels that her kicking off and being so upset about it is what's led to this happening. But I'm not convinced that that's the case.
No, I don't think so either. I think they've just used that as a perfect excuse to do that to her in all seriousness, because you wouldn't be as affected by that you know, they weren't directly affected by what she had done. He was her ex-partner. She was the new girlfriend. They would have no reason to really be upset about what she did. To me, that just sounds like, you know, they've just been opportunistic and they've just used that as an excuse. Yeah. And now, unfortunately, Penny is sort of bearing the brunt of that guilt for their actions.
And not just Penny. I mean, Kim had three kids.
Yeah.
Really sad. So it did go to court. And on the 17th of January 2017, it was the Lady Ray. She sentenced both of them. They had both been charged with murder and also attempt to pervert the course of justice because of the way that they disposed of the remains. Stephen Jackson was sentenced to life imprisonment with a punishment part of 26 years, and he was given a further 8 years for attempting to pervert the course of justice. Frustratingly for me, Michelle Higgins, it was determined that they could not prove that she murdered Kim, so she did not get sentenced for that at all. But she did get the 8 years imprisonment for attempting to pervert the course of justice. Although I have to say, I've read the sentencing statement from Lady Ray, and she makes it perfectly clear that the jury found the murder charge not proven, but you, according to your own evidence, you remained, you watched it, you did nothing to assist Kim, you didn't try and summon help. Because she was claiming, oh, I was so scared of him, I was terrified, I was under control, he's a psychopath, this, that, and the next thing. Which, you know what, this absolutely does happen. I'm sure that there may have been a small element of that, but, you know, she helped him move the body, she went and bought a saw, she was seen in the streets with him walking hand in hand, they went to the shops in the high street, she went out alone to buy the saw, she knew it was being used to cut up the body.
And even her text to him, to me, speaks volumes.
Exactly.
That speaks volumes about her complicity.
Yeah, absolutely. Also, obviously, the police found her in the flat when the body parts were in the flat. She didn't try and say, oh my gosh, thank God you're here.
Or raise the alarm.
You're not going to believe this. Please get me out of this absolute nightmarish hellhole. She just, you know, did nothing and then helped pack up the body parts and transport some to her own flat. So that's what that other address was. So a quote from Lady Ray. Having regard to all this behaviour, I find it very difficult to believe that you were as horrified and as fearful as you professed to be when giving your evidence. However, to your credit, you have been prepared to express remorse, although you have, in my view, minimised the extent of your involvement in charge two. What you both did to the body of the deceased shows a level of depravity, thankfully, not often seen in these courts. And then, listen to this. You, Mr. Jackson, boasted about what you did, not only in respect of the killing, but you boasted that you were sexually aroused when cutting up the body of the deceased.
My God.
What is even more concerning is that you appear to have told a social worker that, faced with a dead body in similar circumstances, you would feel constrained to act in a similar fashion. Unlike your co-accused, you have expressed no remorse whatsoever for your criminal actions. So he was sentenced technically to life imprisonment, but it's a minimum period of 26 years. And then he has the 8 years tacked on, but it was backdated. And to be honest, the end is a bit of a mess because, you know, he was on several bail orders, there was other issues as well, so she had to kind of take all that into account and backdate it to the 2nd of December 2016. It's a mess, total mess. And obviously another thing that they were both arguing is that they were on drugs at the time, so that's they were trying to say that's
yeah, they weren't culpable because they were under the influence of something.
So can you understand why I'm absolutely gobsmacked that I've never heard of that case?
Yeah. I mean, I thought I was up on these things, but there are a lot of cases that I haven't heard about, and this is just another one of them.
It's a small town. You've got all these people. They're on these really strong substances, and it's kind of that small town mentality of everyone knows everyone, everyone's spreading rumors, everyone slept with everyone, you know, that kind of way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's kind of what it feels like. And this poor woman who's been much more vulnerable than some of the others around her has fallen in with them, maybe trying to blend in and, you know, have some sort of group. Did she do the right thing sleeping with her friend's son? Probably not. Does she know that? Yes, she admitted it. She was sorry for it. She the next day tried to go to her best friend's house. Does anyone deserve to die for sleeping with someone that's consenting and of age?
Yeah, and I think the fact she expressed remorse about it.
But at the end of the day, do you know what? If something like that happened, you would perhaps expect to lose your friendship with your best friend. You wouldn't expect two unrelated people. I mean, shouldn't sleep with either of their sons.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, like I say, they've just taken that as an opportunity to harm her.
It also terrifies me that he, you know, if he had this house and he's got all these weapons lying around, and people, you know, he'd reportedly taken sexual favors in payment for drugs. He had this guy that came around to inject him daily. Who knows what else he's done? If that's, you know, the level that he can, it's, I just find it so unlikely that someone can just snap and that's their first time doing something like that and they go to that level. That, I mean, maybe that's just me being naive, but I just can't understand. And then to be able to laugh about it and brag about it, that kind of thing.
Yeah
I mean, really, really sick man. There's been reports of him attacking, you know, prison officers and all that kind of stuff since he's been in, so doesn't sound like he's miraculously become a good person in jail either, which I'm sure you're not surprised by. That's the very sad case of Kimberly McKenzie.
Well, I have a true crime fact just to lift our spirits a wee bit. So in Scotland, it is illegal for a boy under the age of 10 to see a naked mannequin.
What?
This is an arcane but amusing derivative of laws preventing the corruption of youth. Although it is unclear who is liable should it happen. The parents, shop, or perhaps the mannequin. Needless to say, no one has ever been charged with this offence.
That is hilarious. Well, you know when you're in a shop and they do change it, very quickly. Do you think they know, or do you think they just feel a bit bad for it being naked?
I don't know. Do they not usually do that at night when the shop's closed?
I don't know. I used to work in retail when I was a teenager, and honestly, those mannequins are literally, they are the hardest things to get clothes on and off of. We used to have to cut them. Yeah, we used to have to cut some of the trousers and things and pin them on.
I believe that because I remember how hard it was to dress Barbie. And, you know, you had to bend her arms backwards, like, you know, like whatever degrees, just to get her bloody jacket on or something.
Well, if you think about it, when you're going to put a jacket on or jeans on, you bend your knees, you bend your elbows.
Mm.
The mannequins don't do that. Well, the old-fashioned ones don't. I'm sure you get some newfangled ones, but this was in 2000, something like that, when I worked in shops. So it wasn't exactly breaking technology. But yeah, that was an absolute nightmare. But yeah, I always felt a bit, oh, you should have some clothes on.
Do you know that fact just remind me of, have you ever seen that film called Mannequin?
No, but it's, I don't like the sound of it.
Oh no, Emma, it's a brilliant 80s film. Do you know Kim Cattrall from Sex and the City?
I think I might have seen this actually. She comes like,
it's called Mannequin. It's a bloody great 80s film, yet she comes to life.
To be fair, a naked Kim Cattrall mannequin would definitely seduce the youth. She would definitely corrupt the youth. Absolutely.
Would you like to hear a horrifying, not true crime related, but would you like to hear another fact?
Yes, I think.
Well, horrifying for me. That film Mannequin only has 21% rating on Rotten Tomatoes and Metacritic.
That just means you have terrible taste.
I am outraged. I was horrified and really, really disappointed when I found out the rating for one of my favourite films Tell me what your thoughts are on Home Alone 2.
I don't think I've seen it.
Are you joking me?
I honestly don't think I've seen it.
I thought I knew you.
Seriously, I've not. Honestly, I've not seen it.
What is wrong with you? Home Alone is one of my favourite films of all time. I don't normally go for sequels. Yeah. However, Home Alone 2 is the exception to that. Home Alone 2 is a great film.
Oh.
Great. And the original will always be the best for me, but it's a very, very close second, right? Anything after 2, do not entertain, because just no. But Emma, it's completely and utterly worth a watch. But anyway, Rotten Tomatoes rated it 33%, and I am no longer trusting Rotten Tomatoes reviews.
I have a view on sequels, and it's one sequel in particular, and I firmly believe and will always believe that Grease 2 is better than Grease 1.
I'm sorry, but Grease 2 is a hugely underrated film.
I love it so much.
It is so good. It is so underrated.
Cool Rider is probably one of my favourite songs ever.
Yeah, I agree.
I want to just do the dance up and down the ladder, but I know I'd fall off a ladder.
Do you know what? I have newfound respect for you, Emma, because you
love it so much.
You've just gone back up a notch in my book. the notch that you lost from what happened to Home Alone 2. If you watch Grease 2 and like it, go and rate it like 5 stars so we can bump up the reviews.
We need
for
to start a
Grease
campaign.
2. Yeah. Also, yeah, while we're on that subject about campaigns, hashtag bring back Crime Watch.
Yes.
Maybe we should just do our own YouTube version of Crime Watch, and we can be the hosts.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would be totally down for that. We could even rip off the theme music. No, we might get trouble for that.
Hum it. We could hum the theme music kind of out of tune. Da, da, da.
Would like to get in touch with us and give us some case recommendations, please give us some case recommendations, because we do cover them, and also it's tough, you know, the more obscure ones are harder to find, and when they're harder to find, we don't have as much information on them, and it's harder to make a full episode out of them. So if you do have a case that you know about, that you want us to cover, then please do get in touch with us. You can contact us by email. Our email address is info@murdershespoke.net. You can contact us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. Yeah, and even get in touch. If you've enjoyed listening to us, please consider giving us a 5-star rating or review on Apple Podcasts or whatever platform you listen to us on. And we will see you next week.